Stay tuned for Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.
How many tears, now, darling, must a girl let fall? How many years will it take to forgive me for it all? You see, when I took you for granted, I knew not just what I'd done. The perfect one.
Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 26, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Daphne Merkin. Daphne is a former staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to Elle. Her writing frequently appears in The New York Times, Book Forum, Departures, Travel and Leisure, Vogue, Tablet Magazine, and other publications. Her previous books include Enchantment, which won the Edward Lewis Wallant Award for Best Novel on a Jewish Theme, and two collections of essays, Dreaming of Hitler and The Fame Lunches, which was one of the New York Times Book Review's 100 Notable Books of the Year. Her latest book is This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression, and is the focus of our discussion today. Hi, Daphne.
Hi.
So good to have you here. I first recall reading and loving your work some time ago in the New York Times. I think it was the Hers column.
Right.
And before we get into talking about your memoir and other things, could you talk a little bit about your sort of writing journey and seeming commitment to nonfiction?
Yes. Along the way, I was also in book publishing for 6 years. I worked at Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch as an editor and then as a associate publisher. And I sometimes think my sojourn in book publishing, it didn't exactly put me off fiction, but I realized how difficult it was to publish and to get readers for what's called literary fiction. You know, mm-hmm. It sounds nice, but it's a death, a sort of death word, mm-hmm. meaning it's well written. It's the kind of fiction I love to read. And there are writers who do very well. I mean, there are, you know, the Alice Munros of the world who I've profiled, but a lot of sort of articulate interior fiction has a lot of trouble finding a home. I don't know if that directly affected me, but on some level, I began moving off fiction, and I've always loved the essay. The first writing I ever published were book reviews. When I was 20, I wrote for the Times Book Review and the New Republic. I remember I did a review of Jane Bowles, the writer, and it got me a fan letter from Woody Allen, of all people, who said, you know, you write so well, but why are you... I don't know if he said, why are you wasting it on reviewing? And I wrote back, he used some term like that, and I wrote back that I thought book reviewing was an art form in and of itself, which I still do. Mm-hmm. I think well-done book reviews are amazing to read. And I had always admired essays ranging from Virginia Woolf to Hazlitt to the British writer Cyril Connolly. So I think I began in earnest writing longer essays for a publication that came out years ago called 7 Days. It was in a New York publication, and it was my probably first go at writing sustained, you know, ruminative essays. I wrote one, if anyone remembers the case Hedda Nussbaum and Joel Steinberg, you know, with the child abuse. Mm-hmm. I wrote a piece called The Couple Next Door. I wrote an essay called The Visible People, and I think the tagline was, if you went out last night and no one saw you, do you exist? It was sort of about the beginnings, pre-reality TV, of the obsession with celebrity. So I started with that, and then I continued and branched out into writing profiles, which I also like to do very much. And continued on into writing everything from, I went to Sweden to write about a mattress for Departures, mm-hmm. and worked at actually worked on a mattress in a factory, and went to Alaska on a cruise. Also have written a lot about sort of, I guess you could call it the culture of narcissism, you know, in terms of like surgery, cosmetic surgery, women's obsession with their looks, and fashion. So I would say, in some way, for me, a way out of the interior has my own not always happy interior state has been through curiosity about different aspects of the world.
Well, you know, your writing is so literary, and so how nice for you to find success with nonfiction and a memoir.
Right.
You know, it's I think it's probably more unusual. I think fiction writers or people who begin with a love for fiction have a hard time making that transition.
Right, right. I mean, I would say, Barbara, that my love for fiction remains, and my next book is a return to fiction.
Hmm.
The one after this. I've been working on a novel for a long time.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to that.
Right.
But right now, we have This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about when you knew you had a memoir, when you knew you had a book-length manuscript about your early life, your dealing with depression on through to the present.
Right. It was a, if I may say so, a slightly tortured experience because of a number of factors. For one thing, I had written quite a bit autobiographically for The New Yorker, and I didn't want to completely mine the same material. Then there was the whole issue of, actually, this book began as an essay for The New Yorker. In 2001, I published an essay called Black Season, which was about depression and being hospitalized for it. And it had an enormous response from readers, and publishers were very interested, and I had a book contract that long ago. So this comes to explain the tortured part. Many, many years later, and three book contracts later, I figured out how I wanted to write the book. I didn't want it to be, when I first signed up to do a book-length manuscript, I thought I would write a lot about the surrounding issues to depression, to which end I researched gobs of information on every kind of depression you can think of, from postpartum to childhood depression to geriatric depression to, I was going to possibly make it more cultural or equally cultural as it was personal, but the publishers, all of them, successively, were more interested in the personal, partly because I guess that writing is more, I don't want to say rare, certainly more raw than most people have managed when writing about depression. So the inner experience of depression was sort of, I think, what drew the editorial end, the publishing end, and it interested me. There I felt I used what one might call my fiction writing skills, not in the sense of invention, but in the sense of how to make depression, which is essentially inert and sort of flat, how to make it into something vivid and narrative, and that would lend itself to a narrative instead of simply, I mean, as I say in the book, there's something, you know, depression is repetitive. Depression is, frankly, to other people, boring. You know, even if they're sympathetic, there's a certain impatience that attaches to looking on at someone, since it's hard to figure it out. So it took me a long time to figure out how to assemble a narrative, how much I wanted to use my own life. I mean, it's certainly, you know, I made a decision early on that I would not chronologically cover every part of my life, but rather let the theme of the depression determine how much I'd go into different aspects of my own background.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's it's interesting. I don't read books about depression, but I've dealt with it throughout my life. And so your memoir was so interesting to me, and your fiction writing chops certainly show here. Interestingly, I began reading This Close to Happy a few weeks ago, around the time when a couple of young men in their early 20s in my neighborhood committed suicide.
And wow.
The mother of one said she was sorry she didn't talk about their mental illness sooner. And, you know, why is depression and mental illness such a taboo subject?
It is. It's, it remains stigmatized. I have no other way of putting it. I think, and I sort of question this back and forth in the book, I think certain aspects of dysfunction are, you can say in the culture, you can talk about being in recovery, you can talk about going to rehab, you know, that's sort of, I don't know how, what else to say, au courant, a lot of celebrities have it, but real significant mental illness, specifically, I would argue depression, remains under wraps. I think because there's a degree of shame about it, there's a degree of helplessness about it. It also doesn't, depression in particular, despair, doesn't present with any great, noisy, colorful symptoms.
Mm.
You know, it's an absence of affect, of energy, of interest. It's a withdrawal from the world. And then I think, Barbara, another issue is something I've given a lot of thought to, because you would think in today's culture, which everyone is always saying, you know, everything goes, everything's discussed. It interests me how that doesn't apply to mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically to depression, I think partly because depression, somewhere in the book I quote someone, I don't name her, but it actually was the actress Diane Keaton, who said to me once, who I profiled for the Times, said to me once, everyone's a little depressed. No one would say everyone's a little schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
It almost works against depression that it's on a continuum with mood, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
People feel they had a bad day, the dog died, a range of things. They feel down, depressed. The very word depressed and depression is elasticized in the culture and is used so much, so that when it comes to significant clinical depression, I think it's treated as with a degree of suspicion, like the old, you know, Calvinist approach, you know, pull yourself together, take a class, get out of yourself. I think it's not understood, which helps, which furthers a certain amount of distrust and, as I said, stigma. I mean, I myself, you mentioned the boys in your neighborhood. I know in here in Manhattan, there were two suicides in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I was thinking how sad it is that depression so often goes underground. I mean, one was a prominent businessman, very prominent. And I read some of the, read up on him, I think named Charles, I forget his last name, Charles something. And there was some reference in the piece about him, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, that he had suffered, had begun to feel depressed. And, but the other one was the only black judge, female judge, I'm not sure on which court, who was found drowned. And when I read about her, her brother had committed suicide. You know, she was described as this very happy person, and I thought, how, you know, the minute I heard about it, that she was found, they were, in the beginning, they weren't sure if she had, if it was an accident or intentional, I thought. I'm sure she wasn't that happy. But you can disguise depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you sure can. You know, there are so many great descriptions and sentences in your book, and you talk about a parent's love or lack of love can make all the difference in how a kid turns out. And early on in the book you say, "With all that bothers me about myself, is it too large a stretch to imagine myself as someone else sent into the world on a current of love?" I love that sentence and
thank
that,
you.
And that bittersweet sentiment.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, something I think about a lot, especially in the whole, as relates to the whole nature-nurture debate.
Yes.
You know, is depression genetic? I wrote a piece for the Times called "Is Depression Inherited?" about my daughter. And, of course, nothing. I mean, I think the public, partly because the whole nature-nurture, someone once said to me that the nature-nurture debate exists to assign blame.
Mm.
You know, and you say, my parents, my background, or it's all my genes. Of course, genetic input is complicated. There's a 40% genetic input to depression, which only means, it doesn't mean you will get depressed, it means you will have a proclivity, and then life kicks in. And in the end, it is also experience. So I guess, for me, it was, I mean, my growing up was fairly difficult, and I guess I wondered a lot, would I have exactly what you just read? What would it have been like to not have had such a difficult upbringing? I mean, maybe I would have emerged anyway with someone with a vulnerability to depression. But somehow I think probably there would have been more resilience. You know, another interesting factor in all this is how resilient one is or isn't.
Yeah.
But I remember that when I first went, it wasn't the first psychiatrist I went to, because as I detail, I was in therapy, not from birth, but I was in therapy from a fairly young age. But I remember the psychiatrist who first said to me, you know, you should go on medication. No one should live with this amount of, you know, darkness. And I remember saying, but am I medicating a bad childhood?
Mm.
For me, it was always this sort of, I mean, depression is very complicated, and if they ever find, as I assume they will, it will undoubtedly be a collective of genetic, you know, of genes. It's not going to be a single gene for depression. But in, for me, it remains a kind of, I don't know, as you say, sort of wistful thought of a different beginning.
Yeah, yeah. You are listening to KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Daphne Merkin. Her new memoir is This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression. Would you read a little bit to us, Daphne?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm going to just read from here. 1 second. I'm going to read from the very beginning where I kind of explain how... how depression comes on.
Okay.
It's in the very beginning. It's chapter one. Begins with a woman standing in her kitchen making a cup of coffee. Nothing is so terrible. I'm just explaining. And then this happens. The plunge in mood can be sudden and steep, taking her unawares. 1 minute she's feeling more or less okay, the next like shooting her head off. It can occur on a Monday afternoon, for instance, when she's returned home from a dentist appointment to an empty apartment, and the very motes in the air strike her as desolate. She feels isolated, stuck in a cave of grief, of ancient and permanent sorrow. And then right on the wings of this feeling, gurgling up from somewhere inside her, comes the impulse to kill herself. It's so strong that she goes over to the wood block of knives that sits on the kitchen counter and takes one out, running its serrated edge across her thumb. She envisions herself slashing her wrists. No, filling a bathtub with water first, and then slashing her wrists. Isn't that the way to ensure death, the way Deanne Arbus did it? To stop herself from thinking about it any further, she gets into her bed and lies there waiting for the impulse to pass. Then again, the dark season, that's what I call depression, can take its own sweet time to make itself known, stretching out over weeks or even months until it announces itself as having irrevocably arrived. The particular afternoon alluded to here puts in an appearance in mid-March, but it could just as likely be a day in mid-December or mid-August. The condition that envelops her respects no calendar. It arrives precisely when it feels like it. To the woman, meaning me, it seems as she has felt this way in one form or another for what feels like forever. She is always noticing the grime on the bricks, the flaws in her friends, the heartache lying in wait, the sadness that courses just underneath the skin of life, like blood. I could go on a little. I talk about the...
Yeah, go on a little bit more.
Depression is a global problem affecting 350 million people worldwide. In the United States, 16 million people had at least one major depressive episode in 2012. And in 2014, there were more than 40,000 deaths by suicide. And yet, this is a sadness that no one wants to seem to talk about, that no one seems to talk about in public. Not even in this age of indiscretion. At cocktail parties, for instance, you can talk endlessly about attending AA meetings or your stint in rehab without raising any eyebrows. But just imagine trying to tell the truth about how you feel at an upscale social gathering where everyone's milling around, wine glass in hand, keeping a narrowed eye out for the next person, the person who isn't you. How are you? Not fine. Very depressed, in fact. Can barely get out of bed. Have no idea what's happening in the world lately and don't much care. Who wants to hear it? Has ever wanted to hear it? Will ever want to hear it? In spite of our anything goes, tell-all culture, so much of the social realm is closed against too much real personal disclosure, too much ruffling of the surface. We live in a society that is embarrassed by interiority, unless it is presented in a shrill, almost campy style, under the aegis of the recovery movement, with its insistence on dramatic personal testimony. Rigorous self-reflection, a sober and nuanced wrestling with personal demons, has gone out with the great vexed Victorians like John Ruskin, Thomas Carlyle, and Matthew Arnold. And then I go on to say, no matter how much friends want to listen or are willing to, depression is sort of a stubborn one-note reality and becomes boring for other people. And they say things like take a yoga class or get a massage. And then I say just don't go on and on about it is what they don't say. But you can see the resistance to joining you in your gloom and the set of their jaw.
Hmm. That's great. It's so true, isn't it?
Right.
Oh my gosh. Before we go on, I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of my guests and me. I want to talk just a little bit about the process of writing memoir, because we have a lot of listeners who are working on memoirs. And
right.
I've heard it said that if you're thinking to write a memoir, you need to know two things. What's the specific question you're trying to answer, and what's the universal question you're trying to answer? And I'm curious what your take is on this, if it's important to have the answers to these questions at the outset of working on a memoir, or are the answers something you discover as you write?
Yeah, very well put. Having just taught a master class in memoir at Hunter, it's I certainly wouldn't begin with those. I mean, if I began with either question, it would be the one of the specific question. I don't think it helps to think what is the universal question, because no one has universal questions. What the hope is if you write personally with enough candor and enough attention to what you're writing, it will resound with other people. To me, memoir writing is a mixture of organic, meaning not so easy to map out, and at some point, of course, the imperatives of craft come into play. Like, rather than a question, I guess I would say you need, the narrative needs some arc. It needs to go. Doesn't matter how the arc is done. It can be chronological. It could be, as my book is, more circular. I think of my book as a sort of more circular chronology where I begin further on and then I go back to childhood and then I keep kind of jumping back and forth, hoping that I'm keeping, or certainly trying to keep, a thread for the reader to follow in between the jumps. But I would say the first word I put on the little, you know, whatever, whiteboard, I think they're now whiteboards, not blackboards, whatever they are, the first word I put on the blackboard was courage, more than arc or what is it you're trying to answer. I think to write memoir well requires a certain amount of courage, because, you know, you could argue everyone has a story, everyone has a story they could tell, keeping in mind a certain talent for telling it, for writing. But I think what I would call the anxiety of disclosure hovers around memoir writing. Do I dare say what I really think? Do I dare reveal this stark detail of my past? Do I dare describe a feeling that may not be consonant with what other people say about this subject, whatever the subject at hand is? So even though it sounds pop, maybe a little basic, my starting point would be courage, candor. Years ago, I've never myself, I grew up in a big family. I have five siblings. We're all very close in age, although not particularly close. And I always felt my family was secretive. about each other, about what was really going on. And from an early age, I hated secrets. I thought they empowered the powerful, that it's never the people without power who keep the secrets. And I remember years ago, Esquire magazine put out a collection of an anthology of pieces, and the title has stayed with me, which is All Our Secrets Are the Same.
Mm.
On some level, I think there's truth to that, meaning they're all about basic emotions, hurt, loss, hope, delusion, whatever. I think memoir writing requires for it to, like, a kind of, not strictness with the self, but a kind of determination to do battle with one's own inclinations to either write, you know, a cover-up story. You also, I think, have to figure out, and I sometimes have thought this is a bigger issue for women than men, how much are you going to protect? And who are you going to protect? Whom are you going to protect? And is that going to, in some ways, intersect with your story too much? I think those are things that need to be thought through, because when I've taught memoir writing, which I've done quite a bit, it always interests me that people don't even know how much they're protecting. By that I don't mean that you have to expose everything. No one exposes everything. Even the most open-seeming memoir has stuff that is not gone into, that the writer circumvents, but you have to know what you're not going to put in. Do you know what I mean? It can't be inadvertent. Like, you hate your brother, but that's somehow not in it, even though, then know that you're not going to go there. Do you know what I mean? It has to be a conscious accounting.
Right.
Or the book will seem full of holes, or it'll seem dubious.
Well, talk a little bit about writing your own story when you're including others. I mean, you have a big family you're writing about. You write about an affair you had with a book critic. And as I was reading, I was wondering a couple of things. I was wondering if you worried about what people would think, what your family and people close to you would think. And, you know, how do you draw the line between telling your own story and revealing things about others that others may not want revealed?
Right.
And at some point, do you have people you're worried about vet the manuscript?
Right. I'm going to answer the last question first.
Okay.
I would not suggest having people you're worried about, on the whole, vetting the manuscript, because that can lead to a welter of problems, which, for one thing, it's impossible to know when writing who's going to end up insulted. People take against things you think are positive. In my particular case, first of all, I worried incessantly about what I was saying, you know, what people would think. Was this revealing too much? Although the brunt of the revelation is about me. But as you know, I've said, and you just said, there is a whole family around it, and I will honestly say to you that if I could have been, I have my oldest sister with whom I have a complicated relationship, euphemistically, said to me, you know, you should be very, very honest and describe, as we called her ma, our mother, as evil. And I said, or thought, but I didn't find her evil. I found her destructive and complicated and also alluring. So my sister kept saying, you know, are you going to really be able to make clear? But when it came to, you know, she kept saying, you should be honest. But then at some point she wrote me, don't you dare mention X detail about her. And in truth, within my family, there's been more depression than I go into among siblings. Some of it's severe, precisely because, I mean, I allude to the fact that there are holes in all of us, but precisely because I felt it might have made for a stronger narrative, although in the end, I am focusing the narrative on me as the narrator. It might have, you know, furthered my argument that the family was sort of poisoned at its core. But I felt it was their lives, and there was a limit to what I would say about their lives. You know, there was a certain honoring of privacy, but I would say I've certainly read memoirs where there isn't, where I read them and I'm sort of thinking to myself, my God, how come this memoirist is so comfortable talking about a sibling, in my particular case, I would say, even though I wrote an autobiographical novel many, many years earlier, Enchantment, even though I had written autobiographical essays in The New Yorker, about one that has haunted me forever, which was about erotic spanking and how it connected to the painful aspect of my childhood. And I wrote a long piece about money and my family's strange approach to money. I still felt inhibited, and I don't think I would have written this book with either of my parents alive. Even though they, you know, my mother was fairly, I don't know how much of what I wrote, my father, who died many years ago, I don't know how much he read. My mother did read and was a very good reader. And in the book, I say, is the person I often wrote, you know, I would call my mother up and say, should I use the word sweltering or warm? You know, I'd like air these, and she'd list, you know, she wrote a novel herself that was a version of self-published, but, I mean, she had a lot of interest in it. She was interested in writing and words, and I would air those things on her, but I don't think I could have written this book with her alive. Mm. Partly because I try to present a complicated picture of her as not just a bad mother. You know, I say there is a form of love in the end when I have the scene where I'm yelling at her. I go to Israel in a very bad depression where my mother had an apartment and often stayed, and I'm yelling at her that she destroyed all our lives. And I say, you know, she's an elderly woman in a nightgown, and that possibly her form of love is that she takes this all in. You know, she doesn't say, shut up, or, you know, that she kind of withstands the onslaught.
Yeah.
And offers me a cup of tea. But I think memoir writing, because so many people do it, it looks, is a complicated trade-off of what will have narrative draw, narrative worth, value, versus what you are prepared to say. And then there are always those emotional considerations. I mean, do you want to write a memoir and emerge from it and no one in your family ever talks to you again? In the case of my own family, one brother said to me, it wasn't precisely his view, but it was mine. It seemed diplomatic. Another brother protested that I didn't put in something he told me. You know, that's where, I mean, you don't know what people are going to take umbrage at.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what it was. He said, I didn't mention there's an abusive nanny housekeeper figure named Jane.
Yes.
And I talk about her funeral and that for some reason I cry at her funeral. And this other brother said to me, you didn't mention that I gave a speech. And I thought, no, he did give a moving speech, but I forgot. No, so, you know, you don't know.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left. We have Daphne Merkin with us. Her new memoir is This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression, published by FSG. So many more questions, so little time. And, you know, you had mentioned, you know, when you're writing, when you teach, you know, you talk about, you know, the narrative and whether it's chronological or whether it's sort of like what you did, which is, you know, you have the thread, but it's, you're not telling the story chronologically. And I like that structure so much. And I'm curious if you had it from the beginning, or did you write your book in pieces and put it together later? Can you talk a little bit about the actual putting together of the book?
Yeah. I never wanted to write it chronologically, although it was something I toyed with. I did kind of write the book. In some way, it felt like a patchwork quilt, in some ways. But in the very beginning, it felt that way. The more I wrote it and the more I had, I also figured out, well, you know what, you need a vivid scene here to make clear, like there's a scene, a chapter where I'm standing, it's early, in a playpen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the earliest, obviously it must be the earliest, I can't be describing the womb. I decided I wanted to give that sense of very early, very early, you know, you could argue, do I remember standing in a playpen? I don't go into mammoth details, but I say I probably felt, did I feel anxious already then? You know, that no one was coming to pick me up. There were so many other kids. My mother was off in the garden reading or entertaining her Israeli relatives. But I made a decision at various points, you know, I guess they'd say, like, where the narrative needed to be punched up. I write so much with the reader's eye. Like, if I were reading along, would I think, okay, enough of her description of interior life. Let's get some some real feel for scene. So I would say I wrote it in a somewhat, as you say, piece together way.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point it began to take off. For me, it was a consideration. Someone said to me the book has an essayistic feel, which I like. You know, there's a lot of rumination, thinking, but it was important to me to intercut it with a scene with a psychiatrist, with dialogue, a scene with an early boyfriend. It became a kind of juggling act, I would say. Especially because, I mean, in some ways, I resisted a reader, a very good reader who I listened to for many things, but I said I am not, you know, she said chronology is the easiest way of organizing any book for a reader. But I did not want to simply do, and then at 10, I da-da-da-da-da, and then at 15, I was unhappy in school. I wanted to stick to this sort of back-and-forth thing. Because I like reading that way, but I think it's a harder way to write.
Yeah, I like reading that way, too. And it is a harder way to write. There's a lot of revision that it
yes.
seems to require.
A lot. When I think of what I took out, and, you know, there were big pieces that in the end I decided, no, they're too much. Also, when are you giving enough of the feel of something? When have you not provided enough information for the reader to understand? I think the hardest part for me was what I mentioned already, was since it isn't chronological, to make sure that you could follow, keeping that string. And that required a lot of going back in and doing, situating scenes.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I wonder if there's any advice you got along the way in terms of writing, or if you have anything you particularly stress to your students when you're teaching memoir, if you might share that with our listeners.
Yeah. One thing I stress, I guess, is to kind of write with an inner, I don't mean a censorious inner ear, but an inner ear cocked to an imaginary reader and keep the reader in mind. I sometimes think that's the difference between good and less good memoirs and writers, is that you keep a sense of your story, your memoir, that it'll ultimately be an object out in the world, and how to facet it and shape it so that it remains, for better and worse, on some level seductive. Even though that sounds odd to say about a book about depression. But I'm reading a memoir now about a very dark memoir, and I go back and forth in my mind thinking there's something admirable about it, but there's also some way in which she doesn't keep in mind the reader. Enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes I think it's important to... It's interesting. I'm thinking, do I agree with this? Is there a question to answer? I mean, in my own book, I knew I had trouble with how I was going to end it. I didn't want to end on a falsely glowing, to use a word I hate, note of closure. Like, oh, I woke up one morning and all was good. The depression was behind me. You know, some kind of, was some self-help note.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a long time to kind of get to simply, the book was originally going to be called Melancholy Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was writing the end, the scene in a summer rental, and there's a line, whoever thought I'd be this close to happy,
mm-hmm.
that's what I pulled out. I would say write that it's important to write in memoir both with a sense of your own truth and a sense of how to present that truth. How to best, I mean, a sort of unattractive way of putting it would be to say how to package it, but I don't mean package it. I mean, there are things I said in this book that are just unattractive about myself, but that was also important to me to get in. I also have always been a big believer that reading a lot of memoirs helps. I don't really understand people anyway who write and then don't read a lot. I've always said to my students, I don't know a good writer who doesn't read a lot. And there are a lot of good memoirs out there. Difficult is one I love. She's someone else I profiled and ultimately became friends with, someone named Nulo Fuelin.
Mm-hmm.
Are You Somebody? I thought of that book a lot because it doesn't have a straight chronological. And then there was another memoir called Bad Blood by Lorna Sage. I also did think of memoirs that I liked as models. And some of the ones that are very well liked were not. I also think if you're writing about difficult circumstances, how do you find a tone? I mean, the thing that critics rush to throw, particularly at female writers, is self-indulgence. If you write too much about, you know, some version of my parents were mean to me, you know, does that get written off as self-indulgence? But that you find a road between... you know, that you write with some empathy for yourself, but also some appealing crustiness, if you know what I mean.
Mm. That's a great note to end on, and I'm so sorry we have to end.
Oh, I enjoyed this.
I could go on and on talking
right.
to you.
Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and I know you had other appointments you had to get to, and you made this a priority, and I so appreciate that.
Yes.
Thank you,
happy
Daphne.
To.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Daphne Merk and her new wonderful memoir, Is This Close to Happy? A Reckoning with Depression, published by FSG. It's all the time we have for you today. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, stay in the chair, keep writing, and see you here next week.
Been broken in it started me through.